Dog Works Radio is sponsored by Alaska Dog Works. Check out their website at alaskadogworks.com. Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.7 in the Mat-Su Valley. You can hear all of our episodes over on dogworksradio.com. And be sure to head over to any place you are listening to our shows and hit that subscribe button. And if you will, leave us a review. It helps us out on comments and questions that people have about our show and how we can make the show better. So we always appreciate that feedback. And calling in today is my co-host, and he is also the story writer, host, and producer of our latest series, I Did a Rod Through the Decades, Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. I am looking forward very much to being back up in Alaska for the start of the Iditarod in a few weeks from when we're taping this. And it looks like it's going to be a very interesting and very good race.
I agree with you. Over the last couple of months, we have been airing episodes of our latest series called Iditarod Through the Decades. And for folks that are listening now and have made it this far through the series, you know what it's all about. But for folks that might just be listening on a whim or just picking up the series late, what we did is we covered a decade through each episode. So the first episode was the 1960s, the 1970s, the 1980s, and whatnot. And what we tried to do was tie in a little bit of the history of the United States, what was going on in the world, and tied that back to Iditarod. And Alex, I think you did a masterful job bringing those two together, and you told such cool stories about what was happening on the trail, who was winning, who was losing, who was struggling, who was overcoming, obstacles and all of that. I think we did an excellent job with that. So my first thing I want to say is kudos to you and hats off to you. I'm sure you spent a lot of countless hours putting this all together, and I think it ended up being an excellent series. What do you think?
Thank you very much. I think I think it turned out really well. There's always stuff that you wish you had done a little bit better, or stuff that you didn't have time to include, or any of that stuff. And I'm not a historian, and I'm sure that people who are historians would have found additional amazing stuff to include, but I am hopeful that it really kind of conveyed the spirit of what this race is and gave a lot of good information in terms of the history of the race, and hopefully did not get too many things wrong.
Well, first off, you are a storyteller by trade. That's what you do for a living. You live down in Los Angeles, and you make your buck by telling stories. So I have a couple of questions, sort of that nuts and bolts behind the scenes type stuff that I love to ask our authors and filmmakers and whatnot that we have on our show. Is how in the world did you condense down an entire decade of stories on Iditarod into the time constraints that we had? We host our show on a local radio station, and they give us 30 minutes. How in the world did you find that core group of stories to really knock it down into that time frame?
I think for me, and everyone does this a little bit differently, but for me, what I would do is to just make a big, big list of all of the important things that I wanted to that were relevant and I wanted to address, and then try to find some kind of through line that included a lot of these things. It's for me, a lot of it is filtered through the stuff that I find interesting, and if somebody else had done this, they might might have found a bunch of different things interesting, and you know, that wouldn't have been better or worse. It just would have been different. So I sometimes am attracted to things that are a little bit offbeat or a little bit unusual, or people doing things that are out of the box. And it seems that there are a lot of those kind of people who are attracted to mushing and attracted to the Iditarod. So that seemed like it was a good fit. And there were times when I was going through where I was feeling like, oh, I don't have enough material, so I would have to go back and find some more things. And then in terms of some of the tying it into what was going on in you know, the larger society and giving it that kind of context, it's amazing now, even compared to 10 years ago, how much stuff is available on the internet. And there is a lot of government audio and video that is all in public domain that anybody can use, that you can find within, you know, like a couple of minutes. So in the first episode, there was the comparison of trying to do a race like Iditarod, comparing it to the effort to go to the moon. And I thought that was a really great approach to take. And originally I had just written all of that out as narration. And then it occurred to me that I could probably find a lot of those audio clips online. And so I was able to find the John F. Kennedy speech where he challenged America to go to the moon. And then I was able to find the actual audio of from NASA of the lunar landing and the people in Houston, I believe, reacting to that. And I just found all of that within a couple of minutes. And that, you know, that stuff has always been available, but prior to, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, you probably would have had to go to an archive somewhere and actually physically, you know, get a copy on tape of the things that you wanted to use. And it makes me feel like we're living in the future now, that you can literally find so much of that stuff, you know, with a couple of clicks.
Right. So one other question in regards to this nuts and bolts part of it. I know your focus has been telling the stories of the middle to the back of the Packers. We often focus on those stories in our shows and in our daily coverage of Iditarod when we do it. And I know you also made a documentary called Mush the Movie, and it sort of told that story about those back of the Packers. And with this series, you couldn't necessarily focus on just those guys. Now, of course, there are very interesting stories on both sides of the race, you know, those front runners and those contenders for the prize, and then of course those folks that are doing it at the middle to the back of the pack. How did you find that balance in this series, where, you know, the stories that everybody knows, you know, the winners and you know, who took first place, all the way down to those folks that nobody's ever heard about?
You know, for the I have a lot, like many Iditarod fans, I have a lot of books about the Iditarod. So I went through most of these books that I have looking for information that wasn't just you know, the most obvious things.
Right.
And there are a few really wonderful books about Iditarod. That there's a book called Iditarod: The First 10 Years that I would recommend to any serious Iditarod fan, which is put together by a large group of people who call themselves the Old Iditarod Gang. And I think there's maybe three or four dozen of them, and it's a bunch of very short short pieces about very specific things in the first 10 years of the race. And it is absolutely fantastic, and there's so much amazing stuff in there. And then I have books about Joe Reddington Sr. I have books about written by people who ran the first race or the first couple of races. I have, you know, books by Martin Boozer and other people who've won the race. And there's a great book that Craig Medred wrote about the back of the Packers in, I believe, 2010, called Graveyard of Dreams. That is just wonderful. So I went through a lot of this material that I had on hand. And then I did a bunch of online research in terms of looking at articles that were written about the race or about various things in various races. And some of that is, a lot of that has moved online. Some of that, especially from, you know, before maybe 1985 or 1990, is still a little bit hard to find online, but more and more it's moving on there. So I just did a lot of research into those kind of things, and mostly would let one thing or one interesting fact that I learned lead me to the next thing. So it was a little bit serendipitous the way I would find things. I'm sure that, again, if I were a real historian or a real researcher, I would have done it in a much more methodical and organized way. But that's the way that I tend to think, so that's how I approached it.
With that, Alex, I want to apologize to our listeners. I said that this was going to be the last behind-the-scenes question, but it struck me as another one as you were talking there. I know that a lot of your day-to-day story work is you get up in front of a mic and you're telling your story to an audience, and it may be a story that you've either written or an experience you've had, you know, more in your face type things in front of audiences and that sort of thing. How much different was it doing this as a podcast? You know, you had an audience, but you weren't necessarily telling it to someone in particular. How different was it than, you know, your quote unquote day job?
You know, it's completely different.
Okay.
But what I tried to do is to, in preparing it and in writing these and in recording it, to think of it in terms of how I would react to it if I were in the audience. And, which I do with a lot of my other stuff as well, but the difference is that there's no immediate feedback. If you're doing something in front of a live audience, and you can tell when their attention starts wavering and when they start, you know, looking at their phones or doing something like that, or just that they don't seem to be with you, they don't seem to be reacting. There's much less of that when you're, you know, in your office and talking in front of a microphone and there's nobody else around. So before I recorded these things, I tried to put myself in the place of the audience and make sure that I was clear and that I was presenting the material in a way that was, you know, hopefully entertaining and would keep people listening.
Good stuff for sure. I really enjoyed listening to them. I didn't do much editing to them when you sent them over. I just added our intros and outros. I let you do your thing, and you know, you are the master at this. And I want to say how much I appreciate it, and I think our listeners do as well. And what's interesting about a podcast is you may have told the story now, but somebody might listen to this 6 months from now, a year from now, 5 years from now, and, you know, catch up on you know, a podcast series or podcast episode. And I think that's what makes this such a cool medium, is our audience sort of ebbs and flows. It comes and goes. And I think that's a cool cool part of this medium and why I really enjoy it. So, Alex, let's switch gears a little bit, and I want to talk a little bit about the future of Iditarod, at least our take on it and what our thoughts are. This is the 47th running of Iditarod. It started in 1973, and here we are, 2019, and we started our series with some lead-up in the 1960s. You had talked about JFK, talking about landing a man on the moon, and I remember that first episode that we had. One of our listeners sent us a comment and said, wait a second, Iditarod did not start in the 60s. Why are you releasing this as episode number one, the Iditarod through the decades, the 1960s? And I thought that was really interesting, is they thought they already knew the full story, but we sort of tied it together with some parts of history that led up to it, didn't we?
Right. And the other thing that I discovered in putting this together is that, you know, it's a great structure to break this up into decades and talk about these things in decades. But if we're looking at, like, the major flow of the Iditarod and the major stories in Iditarod, they don't always fit neatly into decades, although they almost do. So there are a few things where it's like, well, this continuation of this story, you know, goes a year or two later. One of the things that I tried to do is to be flexible enough to talk about that, not to be afraid to, like, dip back in time a little bit or go a little bit farther forward in time, you know, to talk about specific things as they would come up, which I'm sure is maddening to people who are more, you know, who are more structured and are more, you know, wanting everything to be an exact, you know, lineup of the decades. But the other thing is that even though the Iditarod race didn't start until the 70s, a lot of the important stuff that led up to the race was very much in play in the 1960s, and especially in the late 60s with the races that were the predecessors to Iditarod. So I think we both felt that it was really important to cover that sort of Iditarod prehistory as well as all of the history of Iditarod. And then, of course, once we passed the new millennium, there were two episodes for each decade instead of one episode, which just because there was so much more to cover. Again, that may have bothered a few of our fans, but hopefully by that point they were able to, you know, see where we were going and follow us with it.
So let's jump ahead in time a little bit. The Iditarod is going to start up for that 47th running here in just a couple of weeks. And there's a lot on the table for the future of Iditarod. I know we covered an episode about this same time last year about sort of our take on the future. And we talked a little bit about the recession that we're going through here in Alaska and the falling oil prices and, you know, our difficult economy that we're facing here, where a lot of the nation is not. A lot of them have rebounded from the recession from the mid-2000s, and we're experiencing it quite a bit up here. We also talked about climate change and the weather and how that could potentially come in contact with Iditarod and how that they may face challenges with that. And, you know, I say that, Alex, as I'm looking out my window here in my cabin, and just this weekend, we got about a foot and a half to 2 feet of snow in 2 days. And I know that climate change and weather are entirely different things, but boy, we have a lot of snow up here this year. I know they did a mid-distance race this weekend, and they were really struggling on this same trail that the Iditarod takes with just the amount of snow that is already on the ground. So I do think that climate change and the weather will have an impact of the future of Iditarod. We are getting less snow than we've gotten in the decades past, from the 70s and the 80s and then the 90s. But what is much, much different, I think, is the politics of Iditarod and how that comes into play with sponsorships. I know in the last few years they've lost some major sponsorships, and I know that that's happened in the past, especially at the turn of the century. There were some big sponsors that pulled out for one reason or another. But what seems to be an overwhelming reason now, or at least what everybody blames it on, is the animal rights activists and their role in the sport and how they envision change for the race and for the Iditarod. And that's sort of my take on it. I think those are three very important pieces of the puzzle for the future of Iditarod. What are some that we have not mentioned yet?
I would very much focus on those three as well. The whole thing with Dallas Seavey and his dogs testing positive for prohibited substances, and then the sort of cold war between Dallas and the ITC that has officially been settled, but Dallas is not racing in Iditarod this year. Perhaps he'll return next year. There's been a lot of revamping of the Iditarod board, and there seems to be a recognition that there needs to be a little bit more transparency. In the past, Iditarod has kind of dealt with these things privately, and there have, officially this was the first positive drug test result, although other people will tell you that there have been positive results before, but they've been dealt with privately, and the mushers have been told not to come back or various things like this. I think that the sponsorship and the whole money thing is going to be a very, very big deal in the next few years. It's always been a big deal. There have been sponsors who've come in and come out, but I think that's going to be something very serious. And what I think would be the best answer is for Iditarod to find someone who is a billionaire and loves dog sled racing. And in the same way that Jeff Bezos, who's the richest man alive and is founded Amazon, bought the Washington Post because he felt that it was important and he didn't really care if it lost money, I think Iditarod needs to find a billionaire who loves dog sled racing and will set up some sort of trust that will generate, $5 or $10 million a year that can be spent to support the race. And that way they won't have to be as dependent on all of these sponsors and on making sure that they keep the sponsors. They won't be as vulnerable to the attacks by animal rights groups. And they won't, have to really lean on some of the fans for financial support.
That's a great point. And you had mentioned Jeff Bezos with Amazon, and I'm thinking about the late Paul Allen, one of the founders of Microsoft, and he followed his passions and ended up buying the Seattle Seahawks and the Portland Trailblazers, the professional football and basketball team there, and of course built stadiums and the whole nine yards. And I know that other really well-to-do people have done that, whether it be owning, National Football League teams or soccer teams in Europe or whatever. It is something that happens. I don't know of that person yet in Iditarod. Maybe they're sort of sitting there in the wings, waiting to hear about it. But, you talked about one of the dog mushers in our previous episode, the one previous to this, about becoming masterful at social media and sort of getting that message out. And you had mentioned the story of Blair Braverman and her kind of capturing the emotion on social media. And I think that she is one of the few people out there that can reach that mass audience. I know that she is a writer for Outside Magazine, and that's a very popular magazine, not only in print, but also online, that reaches, you know, a very wide audience. Iditarod is a very closed environment in terms, you know, we have a very small fan base compared to other sports. We hold our cards very close to the vest, so to speak. And it's difficult for a lot of folks, especially outside of kind of the sport in general, to really figure out what the sport's all about. You know, I know that we have a lot of fans in, you know, in the warmer climates like Florida or Arizona or wherever that follow, but we don't have that mass appeal like other sports do, because they just think, oh, it's that race that they run up in Alaska and they're, you know, they're traveling with dogs 1,000 miles. That's what most people know about it. But I think, going on your point, until we can meet that mass audience and go after that that big corporate sponsor, I think that that has to be done first. I think we have to have a really concise PR campaign that just promotes the heck out of Iditarod and their mission is, their function, how the race operates, and, you know, the good parts of Iditarod before we can go after that big money person or that big money corporation like you talk about. What are your thoughts?
I'm not sure. You might be right. I think a lot of these things can happen at the same time. And they may, you know, getting more publicity out there will help find that one person or that one corporation who can really support Iditarod in a big, big way. I think those things really feed on each other. And frankly, you know, I say this every year when I predict that Ali Zirkel will win, but I think it would be such a huge shot in the arm for Iditarod to have a female winner. And there hasn't been one since Susan Butcher in, I think, 1990. So that would almost automatically bring a lot of attention to Iditarod. The other thing is the race is getting faster and faster, and it looks to me like sometime in the next 3 or 4 years we're going to have someone who's going to finish in under 8 days. And that might be, you know, shattering that record might be something that would attract a lot of attention as well.
You know, and that makes me think of an episode we did about the same time where we did that Iditarod Futures episode. We talked about gene doping and sort of that super dog, and if that will ever be a possibility where, you know, they take these two super dogs, whoever they are, and they combine the genes together, not in a mating situation, but a true genetic makeup to make that super dog team. I think that that's a potential reality in this sport. You know, it's happened in other sports where they've used, you know, at the time it was illegal activities, you know, with PEDs and that sort of thing. But I think that quest to just have that super dog team is going to be something in the future, and maybe not in the next 5 years, but maybe in 10. And I think that also goes into play with the technology, and the equipment is getting better every year. You know, nowadays they have $4,000 dog sleds. I know a friend of mine is just now selling his that he used one time in the Yukon Quest, and it's up for sale for $3,500 for a used dog sled. And I remember my first dog sled, I think, was about $600, and, you know, it was just wood and lashing, and, you know, it was a real jalopy compared to what they have now. So I think the technology will change. And then, of course, I think that sort of outside technology is going to change a lot as well. You know, checkpoint operations and the technology at checkpoints, whether it be internet or medical care or, you know, the ability to move things up and down the trail will only get better. I think those are some of the things that will happen in the near future as well. Do you have anything else that you would like to mention?
You know, I keep coming back to this idea of finding a billionaire, finding a really wealthy sponsor, just because there are a lot of great programs that the Iditarod could put in place tomorrow if they had an infusion of, you know, let's say $15 million. And yet you say that to someone on the ITC and they sort of look at you like you're from Mars, because the race itself has a total budget that is much less than that, and they are always scrimping to raise that much money. So the idea of like having an extra $15 million when they're thinking, we're struggling just to get $5 million to be able to run this race properly. So I think that having that kind of real huge infusion of money that could be used in a strategic way, you know, as a forward-thinking way of promoting the Iditarod for the next 5 or 10 years would really make an enormous difference. That doesn't mean that it's going to happen, but I would love to see something like that happen, because the alternative, frankly, is a race that is always struggling and always, you know, trying to cut corners so that they can just put the race on, without being able to think necessarily 3 or 5 years in advance for how they can make it a better experience for the racers and for the fans.
Well, Alex, you are down there very close to Hollywood, and I know that millions and millions of dollars changes hands on a handshake at one of those fancy restaurants. I'm sure that you have seen that happen a time or two. So I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit, and who would be this ideal person or this ideal corporation? If you were going after the money, so to speak, who would you go after? Or maybe not, you know, John Smith in terms of name, but what type of person or what corporation do you think would really align well with this idea in terms of this million-dollar backer that you talk about?
I would go after the tech billionaires. So I would look at people who had made a lot of money in technology not that this is necessarily the person, but someone who's on the caliber of like a Mark Zuckerberg, someone who is excited about technology, maybe is excited about Iditarod for the sport or the romance of it or whatever, not necessarily, you know, someone like a Mark Cuban, who is much more interested in how do I make money on this? How do I turn this into a scalable business? But I think you need someone who's a bit of a dreamer and has access to a large amount of money. So I would look at founders of tech companies that have gone public. And I think that would be where you would be able to get someone who would say, you know, I don't know if this is going to work or not, but let's put $50 million into it. You know, for people who have $50 million burning a hole in their pockets, this is a good thing to do.
You know, I agree with you. And, you know, so many sports, whether it be the other professional sports like football and basketball and baseball, you know, we're aligned with, you know, the sort of prototyperations, whether it be, you know, the snack companies or the alcohol companies, the beer, the whiskey, whatever, the food type companies or the apparel companies. Those are small potatoes compared to what you're thinking about, aren't they? You know, we had talked about losing those major sponsors, and one of those major sponsors was one of those alcohol companies. It was Jack Daniels. And, you know, even the recent news of Coca-Cola, and I'm not quite sure where that even stands here today, whether they're a sponsor or not, I don't know. But, you know, when we're thinking about sports, we also align ourselves with those types of companies. Do you think it would be something different here? Would it be something like, you know, like Hotels.com or Google or Amazon or something like that on a much bigger scale compared to a smaller scale like these beverage companies and the like?
Yeah, and I think it probably is not going to be the companies themselves, but the founders of the companies.
Right.
So I think whenever you're dealing with a large company, they are much more concerned about, about public perception and that sort of thing. When you're dealing with an individual who has a fair amount of money and is able to just do with it what they want, and maybe they've been on a dog sledding trip, or they've met, they've been an Iditarider, or they've met someone like that. I think that's the kind of person that I think really could just take a complete shine to the sport and fall in love with it and want to do something like this, which is an impractical and not a very business-oriented thing to do, but is just something that someone would do because they loved the idea of it.
Right. And, what comes to mind, I know we're just about out of time with this, and of course this is all speculation, but that's what this show is all about, is I saw a documentary just the other night. It was, we talked about Google here a second ago, but it was one of the executives of Google wanted to go up into the stratosphere in a spacesuit and then, fall down from space with a parachute. And he had this idea. Everybody thought he was crazy, and he put all this money together and, formed companies to build this really fancy suit to get this project done. And as you're talking, I'm thinking about a guy like this, a guy that has this passion to do something, and he just went into it with, full gusto, feet to the fire, just really made it happen. And I think that could be what this would take. But this is my last question, and again, I'm going to put you a little bit on the spot. If this, something like this doesn't happen, where do you see the Iditarod in 10 years, the 57th running of Iditarod? So in 2029, so 10 years from now, where do you see it in terms of financials, and where do you see it as in terms of a race in order to make itself viable, taking everything off the table, weather, climate, politics, all of that we've talked about? Do you see it as a functioning race in terms of financials 10 years from now that you see it as it is today?
I think it could either be, without something like that, something like what we're talking about, it either would be very similar to today and really kind of struggling, and 1 year would be great and 1 year would be horrible, or I do think that there's a chance that the race might stop. It might not become, it might become so financially burdensome that it wouldn't be able to be run anymore, or it would be a much, much smaller race where it wasn't necessarily attracting the best mushers and the best dog teams, but it would be just something that people would do because they loved it or they wanted to do it. And that's a sad thought, because I really love Iditarod and I want it to continue.
And with that point, I know we're over time, and hopefully Mike at the radio is not pulling his hair out, but I know that in the last few weeks or months, Dallas Seavey's brother Danny had posted a very interesting concept for the race, and he said something to the effect of, let's run it backwards. So let's run it from Nome to Anchorage, or let's run it 1 year from Bethel to Anchorage, or Bethel to Nome, or from Kotzebue to Anchorage, or whatever. And I remember somebody commented on it and said, that's not Iditarod. And he said, of course it wasn't, but why not start something that is new and fresh? And that's what this was. When we started this series and we started talking about this in the 1960s, this was something that somebody thought about, and they put pen to paper, they wrote down the rules on the proverbial napkin, and they made it happen. And of course that turned into 47 years of racing and why we're talking about it today. But maybe there is a change in the future. Maybe it will be much different, but it will still be kind of in the spirit of and in the vein of Iditarod and all that it led up to. Other sports do it. Other things evolve into something that is different. What is your thought on that? Sort of a different format or a different race itself, but sort of in the spirit of Iditarod?
I think that would be great. You know, it would be great maybe to have three or four different races that each appealed to a smaller niche. But again, as that commentator said, that's not Iditarod, and maybe that's okay that it's not Iditarod.
Right. We'll see. Maybe we'll do this episode every year around Iditarod. What is the future? And see how it evolves, at least here on our little podcast. Alex, do you have anything else you want to add to our episode of the future of Iditarod?
You know, I just want to say, as I think I say every year, that the people who are at the back of the pack, the people who are the mushers who are never going to win Iditarod, I think that those are the people who we need to make sure that we keep them inspired and we keep them part of this race, because they're really the heart and soul of it. And yes, it's great to have Dallas and Mitch Seavey and Jeff King and all of those other people who are going to win the race, and they attract a lot of attention, but we need to make sure, I think the Iditarod needs to make sure that they're keeping with what the real heart of the race is.
Right. That's what started it. That's what started our series, was those people that had a dream to go from one place to another by dog team. And, of course, that has evolved into kind of a supersonic race in terms of dog sledding, of getting from Anchorage to Nome. It's a much, much different race from that 1967 race, and of course the race in 1973, and then as we work through the decades and the dynasties of the Swensons and the Boosers and the Swingleys and the Mackeys and the CVs and all of the people in between, we have had a heck of a run over the last almost 50 years of Iditarod, and it's just going to be really interesting to see what happens in the next few decades as well. Alex, it is a pleasure to have you on. It's a pleasure to be your co-host here and to hear your series, Iditarod Through the Decades. I have no idea where we're going to go for season 3, but we'll talk about that next year.
All right. Thank you so much, Robert. It's been a pleasure as always.
Thank you. Thank you. On behalf of my co-host, Alex Stein, this is Robert Forto for Mushing Radio. We'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.
From DogWorks Radio, this is Mushing Radio. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and we invite you to subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll find a link on the episode notes. You can tap or swipe on the episode cover art, and you'll see some offers from our sponsors. You can support our show by supporting them. If you like what you have heard, we would love it if you could give us a 5-star rating and tell your friends how to subscribe too. Your hosts are Alex Stein and Robert Forto. Our producer is Robert Forto, created for DogWorks Radio. Did you know that Alaska DogWorks trains service dogs for those in need throughout North America? Each and every service dog that is trained through the Lead Dog Service Dog Program and Michelle Forto and her team has an individual training plan. We train for autistic, mobility, psychiatric, and PTSD for our soldiers for service work. If you know of someone that may need a service dog, please take a moment and check out Alaska DogWorks on social media and at alaskadogworks.com.